Warning, the podcast you're about to listen to may contain graphic descriptions of violent assaults, murder, and adult language. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Murder Police Podcast, The Murder of Alex Johnson, Part 4 of 4.
And yeah, I stay on the line with him. I hear the officer pull up. And he's like, yeah, I see the vehicle that you described. And he's like, wait, there's a male white that just came out and got into the car, gave him physical description. He's like, that's what this person looks like. He just went back into the hotel. I'm like, okay, can you guys get some other units there, some detectives there? Because he's got a murder warrant. And while I'm explaining all this to them, I hear the officer get back on the radio. It's like, he's running to the car. He's running to the car. He's in the car. What should we do? It's like, we'll pursue. And it's like, you hear the pursuit traffic go out. It's like, we're taking a left on Random. And Mark wound up wrecking the car about 50 feet from the border.
So he knew they were after him.
Yeah. He probably spotted the officer in the parking lot and was going to make a run for the border.
And wrecked.
They may have wrecked him. I don't know the official story on that.
Just a wreck somehow.
I can just say that the FAR Police Department was a huge, huge help. They were wonderful to work
so
with.
So did he resist arrest when they...
No, he knew he was caught. And they found, I think, 15 pounds of marijuana, a handgun, and two books, Count of Monte Cristo and The Prince, which Luanna Redcorn, again, did a fantastic job at trial explaining the significance of those books. It's basically about revenge and a sociopath taking what he wants. And that just played right into Mark Taylor's persona. What was funny is that we learned, I was talking to a detective down there in Texas. He was like, man, I'll help you out as much as I can. And he goes, it's just 15 pounds of weed. I don't know that I can stretch that into a felony. I'm like, what? And he goes, nah, he goes, we're in the land of cartels. It's like, we catch that all the time. And I was like, well, we're all good because his murder warrant's now entered into NCIC, so you all can hold him on that. And they did a great job of processing the vehicle, all the inventory, and getting it up to us. And they wound up even coming up to testify at the trial. One, I think it's Omar Alvareda, just fantastic. And we came up here and had some drinks. I took him out to dinner. I was like, man, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you guys, because if he'd have gotten across that border, it would have been a nightmare to catch him. He's like, no. He goes, he'd have been dead in a day. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, a gringo coming across the border trying to sell 15 pounds of weed in cartel land. He goes, he would have been tortured and killed. He goes, hopefully you would have found parts of him so you could prove that he was dead. He goes, but no, that's the movies. People going to Mexico and vanishing, especially if they're trying to sell drugs. It's like, you don't do that in their backyard. So that was something I hadn't even thought of.
Wow. What a bizarre, different world.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
Now, did you go down and get him, or who was tasked with going to get him?
Go ahead. It's just the extradition process. Our sheriff's department, Fayette County Sheriff's Department, they handle all the extradition. And it took about a month, for the paperwork to go through, because he tried to fight it.
Still in Texas while he was fighting it, and you all were trying to get the paperwork through to bring him back.
Yes. Yeah.
So then he comes back a month later, and in between time, I guess Tiny's in jail now.
Yeah, we're tying up loose ends, and we talked about how we found out it was premeditated. The barrel that we found had a tracking number on it. It came back to a medical supply company. Then we found out where that medical supply company had sold it, and it had wound up being a neighbor of Mr. Taylor's. And a week before the murder, he contacted him, was like, hey, you mind if you sell me one of those barrels? And he's like, I'll just give it to you. You know, it served its purpose for me. So we found out that he had gotten the barrel a week before, and like he'd taken a blowtorch and made an opening where it would peel back and you could put a body in.
Wow.
And then he drilled holes in it as well so it would sink.
And again, this is his friend.
Yes.
Like we talked about.
Very
that,
good
That's even
friend.
Deeper. A yes. week out that he's already picking that crypt for him.
Yes. Well, and the bad thing is they're probably still having dinner and talking on the phone sure. while he's drilling holes in the barrel.
Oh, still pretending to be best friends. I'm sure there's text conversations. And well, there were because he was talking. It's like, hey, we're going to trust tonight. Make sure you go. I don't know. I don't have a ride. I'll come pick you up.
Oh, you can almost wow. see him on speakerphone with a drill in one hand and talking on the other, getting that barrel. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Frightening, frightening.
One of the loose ends that everybody forgot about, including us, was more most important when you have a jury. Where's the Mercedes, right?
Good question. Good question.
So what we do is we start, where are you going to get rid of a Mercedes? There's a metal company in Lexington that has to report any cars that they damage what the VIN is. So we go ask them for a list of VINs. Lo and behold, we find that that company had smashed his car, but we didn't know who brought the car in. You would think it would be Mark. Well, he was friends with several mechanics because even during the trial, he talked about—
He was flipping cars.
He was flipping cars.
For income.
Right. And he had a mechanic that usually worked on his cars. Well, he dropped the car off to this mechanic and said, I don't care what you do with it. Get rid of it. Whatever you have to do, just get rid of it. He goes, why can't I just buy this from you? He goes, you don't want to buy this car from me.
Yeah,
just
something bad happened. And he wound up testifying. It's like— He goes, I saw what I believe to be a large amount of blood in the back seat and a very strong smell of ammonia. So he obviously tried to clean it, realized it was impossible to do so. So then he just wanted it gone and demolished.
So we get video at the metal factory, and lo and behold, that car came in with spray paint,
yeah.
had damage with like baseball bats. Had done it, and the garage had damaged it, so they would take it at the metal shop, and it wouldn't be driven again to be found.
Fantastic work!
Wow.
Fantastic work! And again, this is that elbow grease and shoe leather.
Yeah, and luck.
True.
You know,
true.
But it's what you make with the breaks that you're given.
Amen.
So yeah, no, I'll take good luck over hard work any day. You know,
that's the story of my life.
Yeah.
So Chris, at this point, I'm assuming since you had a relationship form with this family, were you the one who reached out and said, we found him?
I think both Rob and I did.
I mentioned earlier that Chris buried the huge burden in the beginning of dealing with that family. So I, as I recall, it's like you should be the one to call and tell them. So I think you called.
How did
the
that
parents.
Go?
Oh, a lot of tears. I wish you could speak to the family. Just really down to earth people. And they were just happy, but yet it was bittersweet for them. They have their son back, but yet the end result was not what they wanted.
Was that a phone call or did you ask them to come see you?
It was a phone call. They lived in Western Kentucky, so
yeah,
it was hard.
They were older as well. So we didn't want to burden them with the trip and we had work to do. So we couldn't drop 6 hours and, you know, down there and back drive time.
Well, and there's the, you know, Fran Root talked about this in the 80s with Michael Turpin, is the news will travel faster than
yes.
you will. And that Fran always talked about one of the painful things on that is he couldn't get to the Turpin's house before the news aired.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's awful.
Yeah, and that's where they saw it. And again, so yeah, a phone call, is that always what we'd prefer? No, but
no.
In lieu of them finding out, because you know how this stuff leaks. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's frightening how it leaks.
The media, the day we found the barrel, the media had heard something over one of the radios, and they were sitting up on top of the road waiting to find out what we found. So we would have never made it to Western Kentucky right. on time. One of the things we did do, and this was to show you how stressed the family was while we're looking for Alex, is we did use the media. It's a good resource to have, and we just put it out that he was missing, gave a description of him, and we probably received 200 and some calls, which means you've got to follow those leads. And the family would get calls and say, I saw him at Speedway in Bowling Green. I know it was him. So we would have to go and collect the video and knowing this whole time he was probably murdered. So,
and again, that's what people don't understand is you're busy with these things and the pieces feel like they're falling together. But if you had 200 leads, you have to have 200 closures.
Yes.
Because a good defense attorney will take each one of those. I know that if I hired one, I'd want him to do that. So, again, people don't understand that it's not just proving the case, right. It's disproving 200 other things.
Yes.
So during this time, while Tiny's in jail and you're waiting on Mark to return to Lexington, what's happening in this case, or is it just kind of waiting for Mark to come back?
It really kind of slowed down at that point. We've mentioned Chris located a witness that had cleaned the garage. We located the people that had come to purchase a small amount of marijuana from Mark that night at the garage, interviewed them. But all the big breaks had already been played out. At this point, we were shaping our case together to get it ready for trial. And we knew that wouldn't be for 3 years, but you start immediately thinking like that. You don't think about arrest. You think about conviction. And you are in constant communication with the Commonwealth. Give me a to-do list, whatever you need. I'm going to get it done. So it was a lot of that. And we knew from the fact that Mark had already gotten an attorney and didn't want to speak to us, that we were not going to be able to interview him when he came back, which was, I've talked about this with some people. This is one of the very few times in my career where I've not gotten to sit down in the room with the person I arrested.
So that never happened.
I'd never laid eyes on Mark Taylor in person until the trial started.
That is odd, because at least they tell you no.
Right.
Or to pound sand.
And you kind of, at least, even if they do that, you get a feel for who they are, or just some interaction with them. Mark Taylor, to me, was nothing but a picture until we got to court almost 3 years later.
Now, at this point, had you all found out, or had Tiny told you a motive for why Mark would do this to his dear friend?
Simply greed. As we'd mentioned, Alex was making quite a bit of money selling marijuana to the Gorge. And it's our belief it never was proven, because Mr. Ballard didn't have access to this conversation. But we do know that Alex took Mark on a camping trip down to North Carolina to meet his connect. And we believe that it was Mark formulated a plan. She doesn't know anybody else in Kentucky except for me and Alex. If Alex disappeared, I'm the logical next step to continue the drug trafficking and make her a lot of money. And it came out in trial that Alex was trying to get out of it. He was going to start up that business, but it just didn't happen fast enough for Mark. So he was not patient enough, and he wanted what was his and was okay within his mind. And wound up killing Alex Johnson to take over selling marijuana to hikers at the Gorge.
Unreal. The old cutting out the middleman.
Yes, exactly.
Did you all ever speak to the person in North Carolina?
We transferred that information along to the DEA. Since it was out of our jurisdiction, I'm not sure if anything came of it.
So you get Mark brought back. You've not laid eyes on him till the trial. So speaking of this trial, what ends up happening?
Mr. Ballard had pled already. He took, I believe, 25 years on the kidnapping and the tampering. And he was going to be a witness for the prosecution, which he held up his end of the bargain. He testified very similarly to the statements he gave us on that day. So he was a good witness for us. It played out like we thought. Mark was putting all the blame on Mr. Ballard, that he was scared of him. That's why he didn't call the police after Mr. Ballard had murdered his friend. And again, the excuse he gave for the video was Mr. Ballard had already killed him. He was trying to give him CPR. But
by the blows to the head.
Okay. Yes. And as I recall, there's CPR. There's some rescue breathing going on as well, but that didn't appear in the video.
I was an EMT on an ambulance in the 80s, but maybe things have changed. But I think back then we just did chest compressions and helped people breathe.
And again, I think that goes to his arrogance, that he can just take the stand and tell these tales, and people are just going to believe it because it came out of his mouth.
So clearly, he actually testified his own trial?
We were amazed that he testified.
Holy moly.
Yeah. And again, Luanna Redcorn did a fantastic job cross-examining him, breaking him down, exposing him, really. And I had prepped for that trial like I'd never prepped for a trial. I mean, like, I think 3 weeks before the actual trial started, I told my boss, like, leave me alone. I'm doing nothing but this case to get ready for trial. And I was on direct examination for probably 2 hours with the Commonwealth. And then it came time for cross-examination from the defense. And I was like, all right, I'm ready. Let's go. They asked one question of the lead investigator, and it was something to do about Well, the blood at the garage that was collected, it was never identified as to Mr. Johnson's blood. I believe I testified something that was like, well, it was impossible to due to the cleaning agent that was located with the blood, which would indicate that someone tried to cover it up. Defense counsel whispered in each other's ear, and then they said, no further questions.
Oh, Lord.
I'd never in my life had to just answer one question in a murder trial.
Me either.
Does that sound similar?
It does. We'll tell that story one day. That's amazing, though.
Yeah, I was almost shocked.
Yeah.
I was like, so I'm really getting off the stand here.
Yeah, you start wondering what's up their sleeve.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's pretty spooky.
Yeah, but it was bizarre. I'd never had that happen before or since.
But Mark spoke so confidently at that trial when he was testifying, I think he believed that he could convince at least one juror.
I was going to ask his demeanor. Was he smug? Was he humble? How was he?
Confident but humble. He knew the role to play. Yeah, he testified like an expert. I mean, he really was charming to the jury. It's like, I'm a small guy. Mr. Ballard's so big. I was really scared. I didn't know what to do. I'm so sorry. I should have called the police, but I was so scared.
And I imagine Mr. Ballard was livid when he pointed the finger at him because the evidence showed that Mr. Ballard didn't do the beating.
Correct.
Yeah, that's when Tiny was probably glad he did the math.
Right. And that's what we told him that day in his house is exactly what they tried to portray.
Mm-hmm. Now, I will say this, and we'll pitch it in the show notes, but locally, a news anchor, Kristen Flum, P-F-L-U-M, common spelling as we joke, is a wonderful person. She did a multi-series podcast called Taking Alex. And I do want people to take a listen to it because she actually took time to speak to the family. And she has audio of Mark testifying. And I've listened to it, and people need to hear that to understand just how bizarre he was, how controlling he was. And the one thing I noticed, I mean, when we were listening, driving somewhere, is Luanna Redcorn did successfully get under his skin more than once. And it was, I told Wendy, I said, that's Luanna. And I said that, you know, he came prepared to some degree until she took a hit at him, and you could feel him start to fall apart after she said two or three things. So I'll put something in the show notes with links over to Kristen's fantastic series on Taking Alex, because she takes it in a little bit of a different direction and has that audio, but she did an excellent job with that.
Yeah, she really followed up post-trial as well, all this. And again, I was floored when I found out that former Governor Bevin had signed a pardon for Mark Taylor. It just was never submitted. The FBI was looking into it. I believe he did something like 700 pardons, but just never submitted them. So I believe Kristen was the first one to tell him, interviewing him for this, that, yeah, the governor had signed your pardon. He just never submitted it. So
yeah, that's a big scandal in Kentucky for people that are outside Kentucky. You can Google that, but it upset a lot of people in law enforcement because of the fact that for some reason people got mulligans and free passes for murders and sex offenses, which is just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Well, and not only for law enforcement after your all's hard work, but for the family.
I couldn't even imagine telling them.
To know that he's going to be pardoned after or whomever the murderer was on any case, to be pardoned after taking their loved one's life is just such a slap in the face of everybody. And I agree with you also, David. That's not something that I even agree with. I don't think many people aside of the murderer would agree with that.
Yeah, it was but we found out about it, and luckily it was never submitted, but we took the steps to provide information to Governor Beshear's office now because we knew that upon learning that he would try to resubmit for the pardon. So they're well aware of the evidence that we had and assured us that if any inquiry would be made, they'd be interviewing detectives, prosecutors, so it won't be anything like that potentially could have happened with Governor Bevin.
Well, on this trial, what was the end result of the trial? And how long did the trial take? Was it a long one, short one?
It was. I believe it wound up being 3 weeks. And initially, it was a death penalty case. But to the defense attorney's credit, they found a problem with the wording in the legislation to the aggravating factors of murder, that kidnapping, which had always been considered an aggravating factor, along with robbery, burglary, any other felony offense or killing a police officer would be eligible for the death penalty. but the wording was not written so well. So they made the argument that kidnapping was no longer an aggregating factor, and they wound up getting it successfully heard. So the death penalty was taken off the table. So Mr. Taylor wound up getting 49 years in prison, and Mr. Ballard agreed to 25 years.
So there's parole eligibility probably sooner than we'd like to.
25 years, I believe he can see the parole board.
Gotcha. At least that's a little comforting.
Which is worrisome with him a little bit because he's very convincing.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah, that's and again, if people will listen to that audio that Kristen has on hers, you'll hear that. And it's pretty
spooky.
He
has a free Mark Taylor website with a lot of misinformation out there, urging people to contact the governor's office and assist in his pardon. So really just unbelievable stuff on his part.
Yep, bizarre. Bizarre. Have y'all stayed in contact with the family at all? Did you, report-wise, what's that like?
Yeah, quite a bit. I've spoken with the mother of Alex a couple of times on the phone. The sister is who I've mainly stayed in contact with, and really got reconnected here lately because of Kristen's podcast. She interviewed them, and of course, she had been contacted by Kristen, and she contacted me to see if she's on the up and up. And I certainly vouch for Kristen. You know, she's done fantastic work for several years here and grown to be a friend of mine. So certainly vouch for her. And so we all got together and met, and then she felt comfortable with Kristen. And so, and that also allowed Alex's sister and I to reconnect, and we text from time to time, and we'll meet when she's in town.
Good. And it's probably healthy for her to talk about Alex.
Yeah. That's after the whole podcast with Kristen, she was like, it was really therapeutic. It's not that I will ever forget him, but talking about him again, yeah, so much.
We've had other people on the podcast so far talk about the importance of those loved ones simply talking about these people who they met so that they're not forgotten. And it's one of the reasons we started this, was to memorialize these people in another way.
Mm-hmm. You know, some detectives will talk about solving certain cases, and Rob and I talked about this before. I think the most rewarding thing that I've ever experienced in any of my cases, and it goes for all the homicide cases I dealt with, is at the end of the trial, when you get that guilty verdict and then the sentencing, just connecting with the family, mm-hmm. and just the hugs, because you've become close to them. And I think that is more rewarding than anything to me.
Yeah. I had a moment when the verdict was read and the courtroom was empty, like everybody had left, and I was sitting there still in the back row by myself. And it was a very nice moment of just a deep breath. And it's like, that's over. Because it was a big case. It was a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. Chris and I think I mentioned before, it felt like we didn't see our families for 6 weeks straight because of this thing. And to have it finally over and with a good closure for the family. And then out of nowhere, Judge Thomas Clark walked out from behind his office and made a point and said, Rob, that was some damn fine police work you guys did. And I really have respected for Judge Clark for a long time. And to hear that at the very end was very satisfying. And, you know, anytime someone you respect appreciates what you do, it always feels good. And told Chris what he had said. And so, but the weird thing about homicide investigations is, yet you did a great job. You put it down. You got a conviction. You're going to get a phone call probably that night about another one. That's, so it never, ever ends.
Exactly. And the ones that are on the shelf behind you.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, thank you all so much, Rob and Chris. Thank you all for coming in. But mostly, thank you for the hard work and tireless hours that you put in to this case for Mr. Alex Johnson. Your all's work, it amazes me how you all do this. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, and thank you for having us. Again, it's a bit morbid, but we do enjoy talking about these cases. It was very important to us at the time. And, you know, it helps me not forget, you know, how important the job can be, because it is very frustrating and time consuming, and it can become a grind. But with enough distance, you recognize that you're doing something good. You know, and it's hard, but it's rewarding. And We were very fortunate to have a team on this case that everybody put their heart and soul into this case and did a lot of good work. And again, we caught some breaks and made the most of it. And I hate that Alex had to lose his life, but anything other than bringing him back, I think this is the next best thing that we could have done for his family.
Yeah, and speaking of the family, thank you all so much for keeping them up to date and answering those calls. I know that it's probably all hours of the night was probably a little frustrating, but to a family, I'm sure that meant so much. So thank you all for doing that as well, for never leaving them in the dark to wonder. So
I would do it all over again. Answer their calls at any time. That's what we're there for.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, thanks for coming on. We'd like to have y'all back.
Absolutely.
I'm sitting there thinking of cases, and definitely I want you to come back and let's talk about cold case investigation.
Sure.
Because I think that's a fascinating. I always told Chris all the way up to the time I retired that if I could go back and do anything, it would probably be just to drop in a cold case for a while.
It's I've really enjoyed it. Chris did it for several years, and then he retired, and they kind of didn't have the funding for the unit, and Albert Johnson was able to get it up and going and ask if I would take it over, and have been at it for a year. And it's more difficult because these cases are cold for a reason. You know, people put work into them and they just didn't go down. But it's also nice because you are no longer in that grind of a homicide rotation. You can work more at your own pace. And when you can work that way, I think you do better work. So we've had some success here lately and closed like 3 cold cases. And so it's been rewarding and fun. And it's kind of reinvigorated me as far as enjoying investigations again.
Oh, yeah. I think it would be the ultimate.
It really is. It's
your biggest hurdle in cold cases is getting to get everybody to understand when you pick up that file, you choose a file, the low-hanging fruit. But once you get that finished and completed, then you have a case. It takes weeks to read the file and really to dissect it of what you need to do because it's cold.
And pretty much you have to redo everything you've seen done in it. And that's what people don't understand.
Very methodical.
Right. Yep. Pretty much everything has to be done again. Even if it looks good and supports your theory, it all has to be done again. So, well, y'all come back and let's do some of that. I think the listeners would really enjoy it. So,
absolutely.
Sure. Love to.
Good deal. Well, have a good evening and thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
The Murder Police Podcast is hosted by Wendy and David Lyons and was created to honor the lives of crime victims so their names are never forgotten. It is produced, recorded, and edited by David Lyons. The Murder Police Podcast can be found on your favorite Apple or Android podcast platform, as well as at murderpolicepodcast.com, which is our website and has show notes for imagery and audio and video files related to the cases you're going to hear. We are also on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, LinkedIn, and YouTube, which has closed caption available for those that are hearing impaired. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe for more and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcast from. Subscribe to the Murder Police Podcast and set your player to automatically download new episodes so you get the new ones as soon as they drop. And please, tell your friends.
Lock it down, Judy.